Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KYAH. Utah's Talk Authority with your hosts, Al Warren and Kev Thompson. Also, Julie Saville with the Paranormal Report. The True Crime Commentary by Stephen David Lampley. And Dr. Joseph Usensky's Conspiracy Countdown.
You're back for another episode of The House of Mystery. And in the house today with me is Kev Thompson. How are you doing?
Hey, I am doing great today.
Yeah, you sound like you've been doing good for a while. I don't know what's going on. It's probably because I've been away.
Yeah. You said it, not me.
I know. Another rainy day, of course, in Seattle. We'll be having that for the next 6 months, which is great. Three more stations are interested in picking us up. We've also got the new app was released yesterday for the show itself, and it's just version 1, and it's just for the iPhone. The Android is coming out shortly. They're making that as well. It was just the iPhone finished first. I know I was catching grief online for that. I was like, I don't know. Maybe it was.
Well, why does Apple get all the good stuff?
Well, no, it's just I don't. You know, I think it was just. They are able to do it faster, or maybe, I don't know. It's just, it'll just be a week or so, like, relax.
Oh, all right.
You know, I mean, it wasn't planned. So, that'll be fixed shortly for those in, you know, in the Samsung world or whatever. And Nancy Grace was on again, and another great show.
That was fun.
She's actually an animal. But that, which is cool. Now, today we're we're not really doing true crime like we, in the sense of Nancy Grace and Crime Con and all that, but we've got a guest
action
on.
Action adventure.
Yeah. And I picked up on his book there. It was called Some Gave It All. And, really interested me. It caught my eye, and I got a hold of him, and we've been kind of chit-chatting online for a while now. The book officially comes out May 1st, so we thought we'd do a nice little talk about it. So he's here with us in the house, and his name's Danny Lane. Thank you for being here, Danny.
It's an honor to be on your show, Alan. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for saying that. We just love having good people, good writers, good stories, good.
Yeah, all the way around.
All the way around. Now, this caught my eye especially because it seems war has been a part and a big impact on our lives. And I'm 56 here, and I know for you as well, Danny, and I know for sure with Kevin. So war has been a big part of all of our lives, our whole lives, and quite a few of our parents' lives. And this, Some Gave All, is through the fire of the Vietnam War. So maybe tell us a little bit about the book itself and how you got into actually writing it?
Well, you know, it took me more than 2 years to really put it together because I did so much research. I did the declassified documents from the Marine Corps to verify, you know, what I remember after more than, 40-some years after I got back. Also reconnected with some of my squad that was in my unit that were still alive to brainstorm with them. So the biggest thing is, you know, I was there in 68 and 69. That was the height of the Vietnam War. I was a 19-year-old kid. I was homeless at the time. I got a draft notice to go into the Army, you know, so I said, well, I'm not going into the Army because my stepfather that adopted me was a Marine. So I went and joined the Marines at the height of the war and said, you know, get me out of here, save me, because if I didn't, I was going to fall into, you know, a life of crime. I was, like I said, I was homeless, was broke, didn't have a car, didn't have a place to live, was getting ready to pull a robbery, and that's kind of explained in my book. You know, sometimes people hit lows, and then you pick yourself up. So I joined the Marine Corps and left town and ended up there in Paris Island. And, you know, they made me a Marine. In Paris Island, I met another person that's in the book. He was from Greece. Had just gotten his American citizenship, and we become good friends. And we went through all the boot camp and all the ITR and Camp Lejeune. We went to Camp Pendleton together, went through advanced infantry training and prisoner of war training, went to Okinawa, and then we ended up in Vietnam like 6 months later, right in the same foxhole. So the book is a lot about friendship. It's a lot about mine and the Greeks' adventures there. But, you know, it's a story of survival. It's a story of sacrifice. And it's a story of brotherhood that you grow having with other young men in combat that only Marines can have. And, you know, but it's much more than that, because when you go through my journey, you also go back through my childhood and see how I ended up going there and what happened to me. I guess what God's plan was for me at the time I was a kid, you don't realize it until these things are happening to you that don't have control over, that, you know, your life's already laid out for you. You just have to follow that plan and execute what's ahead for you. And I started learning that a lot over there because people were dropping left and right of me all the time. Marines were being killed and you know, I'm still standing and going through this, and you wonder, you know, who's next and so forth. So you pretty much just stop worrying about if you're going to be killed that day or that night, and just accept whatever your fate is going to happen and just keep moving forward as a warrior. But in the book, it's kind of an adventure of my more than 300 days in combat in Vietnam and all these missions we were on and how we grew together as young men, young teenagers from all walks of life and went through all these adventures together, and some of us made it and some of us didn't. But your question is, why did I write it? You know, I've been suffering from post-traumatic stress ever since I come back and didn't know it because until 1983, I don't think VA even recognized that was a problem with veterans. So as soon as I got back, I became a police officer. So I'm a police officer out there on the streets of America still trying to save America just like I was in war. I mean, I was a very aggressive cop, and like I said, I was trying to save the world, and I had all these emotional problems. I had a lot of anxiety and all this going on that I didn't know was going on with me, flashbacks and things. And, you know, there wasn't a big study from Vietnam veterans at that time. But, you know, as a police officer, I still had the adrenaline rush that I got in chasing the bad guys and you know, arresting people and an occasional shootout that we'd have. And, you know, it wasn't anything like Vietnam, but I fueled myself with that adrenaline. And yeah. Then, you know, shortly after I got back as well, I got involved in martial arts. So I became a fighter, you know, on the circuit. I became a kickboxer and a professional fighter. And I fueled my adrenaline fuel that way as well. So, you know, as I got older and I kind of retired from doing things so professionally, more into teaching and stuff. I mean, I've always suffered with it and been through a lot of treatments through VA and stuff that didn't work for me. So just a few years ago, you know, my wife saw, you know, I was still struggling with it. And she said, look, you got to write out your story because your story can help other people, help them get through it. But you have to write out your story because everybody needs to know your story. So I kind of started writing it, and I met one of my students is in my martial arts program. He's a writer, a very accomplished writer, Mark Bowser, and he had a contract with Major Success Publishing there in Seattle through Brian Heathman, who's a very great publisher.
Yeah.
And so he passed my story by Brian, and Brian said, "Look, I'll sign you to a contract. I want to know your story." So that's how all this started.
Do you find it really difficult to, how do I say this? So when you came back from the war and you became a police officer, were you still trying to fill that some sort of need or some sort of void mm-hmm. that you never were able to do? Is that sort of what...
Exactly.
Yeah, and so how do you suggest people do that that are coming back from war now? And or it's really hard for me to say. I haven't been, so I'm trying to figure out what needs to be done the U.S. to help people.
Yeah. To kind of preface the question, it sounds like when you came back, Danny, you almost were looking for outlets that were in that same genre that allowed you to still feel that sharpness, that adrenaline that you felt in combat.
That's exactly right. I mean, like I said, I got into martial arts, become a competitor, and I ended up meeting Chuck Norris in 1980, and I've been working out with Chuck since then during these movies and stuff, but I still fought on the circuit. I was fighting on the streets as a cop. In my pastime, I took a job as a bodyguard. I did high-profile bodyguarding in Manhattan against people that had hits on them from the mob. I considered being a mercenary overseas. Couldn't get enough of the adrenaline, and you can never really produce... You know, when you have a Marine company online and you have all your weapons going, you've got artillery coming in, you got the jets coming in, and you go into a tree line, you fight these guys hand to hand. I mean, you can't duplicate that in any movie. You can't duplicate that in any situation. So you're exactly right. I'm trying to fuel that. You know, I did everything I could to create danger and create this conflict in me so I could either try to handle it or overcome it. And you can never pacify yourself with it because it doesn't exist. And when you go to veterans and they try to give you medication and Prozac and, you know, all kinds of tranquilizers and things to try to sedate you. I mean, I couldn't function on those things and still be a cop and still be a martial artist. So, I mean, I had to deal with it. And my therapy, what pretty much got me through it was just basically exercise, working out 6 hours a day and things like that over the many, many years. And then going back on the street and finding the bad guy and, you know, making a big arrest and, you know, and pretty much drives you crazy. But, you know, it really is hard on the family and people that know you. You drive them away. You don't want them to be involved in your world. Plus, you don't tell them about it. I've never told anybody my story that you'll read in Some Gave All, not even the therapist that I've had to be debriefed with as a Marine. They don't know the extent of all these missions we went on, what we did, the atrocities we committed, the atrocities we saw, you know, by killing civilians, men, women, and children, in the course of battle. And until I wrote this book, and like I said, I've written it for kind of like therapeutical purposes. And during the writing of it, you know, I had a lot of breakdowns. I cried a lot writing this book, pouring my heart into it, reliving it all. But, you know, it's been really good. And I'm also an ambassador for a veteran's charity called Mission 22. And basically that name comes from almost 22 veterans a day are killing themselves at their own hands. And, you know, that has to stop. I mean, we can help these people. We do have several treatment programs that take people, and we exercise with them. We take them on hikes. We, you know, we try to do everything except putting them on medication to give them a reason to live instead of finding a reason to die. Because I've almost been there, and I hope this book will help people do that. I mean, when the book opens, you'll see a scene where I'm on a railroad track waiting for an Amtrak to run over me. And that's in the very opening scene right after the flashback that where the book opens. And then, you know, when the doctors, I'm rushed to a hospital, luckily this person come out of nowhere, kind of like a guardian angel, and we figured they were winos where these people drank and they laid around the railroad track, pushed me off the track right before I got run over. But, you know, I collapsed after that, and I was taken to a hospital. So the book pretty much opens with me in the hospital, and the doctors are rushing to try to save my life and find out who I am and what's going on in my mind. And then my, you know, this whole story unfolds in Vietnam on what drove me to that point 38 years later, that I'm in the hospital bed fighting for my life, but what happened to me 38 years earlier in Vietnam is what they're trying to find out.
Well, to kind of circle back to Al's question, what would you suggest to those who don't have writing as an outlet, who do hold it all in? And because, I mean, like Al said in the beginning of the show, war has become such, you know, such a large part of our lives. I mean, I can't remember a time when we weren't at war. And,
well,
and there,
here's what I would suggest now that I look back on it, because I didn't handle it that way. My therapy was exercise, maybe sleep 2 or 3 hours a day, get on the street doing something else. And I kind of suppressed my adrenaline and all my anxiety by having these high-risk occupations, you know, being a fighter, being a bodyguard, you know, being a cop. But now that I'm retired and looking back on it, and what we're doing now is a lot of exercise, change your diet, get off the prescription drugs, get people that love you, get people that understand your story. Talk it out if you want to talk it out to people like me that's been there, understand, and knows what you're going through. Because some people, when they read the book, they can't imagine that people would go through what we went through. And that's just my story. You know, I mean, of course, I was a Marine, and we were in combat, and we were ground soldiers. I mean, we went in, we did search and destroys. We went into bunkers, and we killed people hand-to-hand sometimes. You know, and to put a 19-year-old and 20-year-old through that, it almost seems, you know, cruel, but, you know, we were kids, and they transport you into these killing machines, and you're given the latitude to kill anything that moves. That's a lot of responsibility to put on kids and Marines. So when you come back and they want you to be a normal person, it's totally impossible because, you know, they debrief you in San Diego for a few days, and you have to pass these tests psychologically, and then you're ready to go. But what I've done, you know, my wife loves me. You know, we, I put it in God's hands. I wasn't overly religious, but I've become more that way in recent years because I've had to, you know, you have to ask for forgiveness for doing what you did. But then when you look at the situation we were put in, we were following orders. We took an oath as a Marine to defend our country against all enemies, you know, foreign and domestic, to support the Constitution of the United States and follow the orders of the President. And that's exactly what we did. We did what we were told, and we did what we had. So, I mean, you have to forgive yourself, and you have to ask for forgiveness, then you have to ask your family to love you and understand you, because we're going to have bad days, and, you know, we just can't make it all go away, but you can live a happier life, and you have to find a reason to live instead of die, like these guys are killing themselves. And I've been there before. I looked at a gun before, even when I was a cop, just wanting the pain and all the guilt to go away. And, you know, I decided against it because, you know, I had children. I didn't want them to think that, you know, your dad couldn't handle all this. Because everybody's always looked up to me as a Marine, a cop, a martial arts champion, and things like that, that nothing, you know, could ever stop me. But they didn't know that I was fighting this battle inside me that was just devastating. I mean, it's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
So now when you look back at things, and when you were the 19-year-old and the Vietnam War, how do you see that war now? Like, there's a lot of controversy about it and all sorts of talk about it and how a lot of the vets were treated when they came home from the war was awful.
Several of my friends, inside my book, too, you'll see a bonus section. You'll see a four-day battle of Way written by a good friend of mine, John Letego, who wrote Dirty Boys and also the Near Enemy. He's a retired FBI agent. He was highly decorated in Vietnam as a Marine. There's also another article in the back of the book written by Colonel Torres. He was in one of the battles with me, and as a young Marine, 19-year-old Hispanic guy from New York City, we all had the same stories. We were young kids putting in a situation. It got political. They didn't let us do our job. They didn't let us bomb the North. They didn't let us go in there. We would take ground, and then we would give it back. And it got so discouraging because we're out in the jungle. One of the missions I described in the book was 93 days. You lose track of time and what's going on. We fight for these mountains. We take these hills. We sacrifice all these men or killed. And then as soon as we take this hill, we get in a helicopter and give it right back to them. And then, you know, 2 or 3 months later, we come back to the same place and fight them again. I mean, it was so ridiculous. I mean,
never-ending cycle.
In contradiction to what some of the declassified documents I had on all these officers' report, they were talking about the morale being high, they were talking about the success. And, you know, the biggest joke of the whole thing is the politicians, you know, LBJ and this McNamara, who was the Secretary of State, I think, at the time, or the he was in charge of whatever, he made all these decisions, they blatantly lied to the American public about what was going on over there. And it got down to where, you know, okay, it got down to, you know, a body count. I just find it so amazing when I read all these reports on how many bodies that we killed of them, which was no way of knowing. We only knew how many soldiers we lost because, you know, we had record of who we were. But there was no way after the battle we had of how many dead bodies were out there because there was nobody out there counting them.
Right.
And they just made that up as fictitious. And they wanted the American public to know, well, you know, the Marines, there was 800 Marines killed, but, you know, we killed 2,000 MDA. It was all about us winning and killing more of them than us. And it was a fabrication that they told the American public, and it was all political. And that's why that angers all of us, the Vietnam veterans, because they just lied about everything that was going on over there.
Yeah, continuous. And then the way they treat you when you're back. It's atrocious.
Yeah, that was a joke. When I got into San Diego, I hadn't turned 21 yet, so I got thrown out of the first bar. I went in to try to get a beer, and I wasn't even able to buy a beer. I said, I just got back from Vietnam. You know, I'm a Marine. They said, we don't care. You can get your butt out of here. You know, you don't have an ID.
Oh, they couldn't give you a...
Yeah.
I went and bought a fake ID for $650 just so I could drink a beer when I got back.
And back then, that was a fortune.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I had two AK-47s. I brought back as souvenirs. We were allowed to bring two weapons, and so I sold them each to somebody. And then I got this Marine Corps ID on a black market over there. I guess they had Social Security numbers and people that had been deceased. So I become William Helbig instead of Danny Lane. You know, and had my picture on my Marine Corps ID. So I said, you know, whatever it takes.
Yeah,
you know, I'm not.
Have you ever gone back to Vietnam or since?
No,
then?
No. You know, the sad thing of it is, you know, it was more than 20 years before I even put my medals up, and then I had to order them from the Marine Corps. They didn't give us our medals when we got back. There was no parades. There was nothing. There was no fanfare. They gave me two options. Look. You've been in the military. I mean, you're in the infantry, so we can't send you back to Vietnam right now. So you can either go to Spain, we'll promote you to sergeant, or you can get out. So I said, well, I'll just get out because I had a job waiting on me at the police department. So, you know, then 20-some years, I finally ended up ordering my medals, you know, for my DD-214, put them up on the wall, started being proud of what I did instead of ashamed of what I did. And, you know, just now recently, you know, people are starting to talk about Vietnam. There's some really great books come out, you know, The Battle of Way, and there's some other ones that's over there and talking about post-traumatic stress. And this series that they did on public broadcasting was a
very good
miniseries. He did a really good job on that, but, you know. The public needs to know this stuff. We didn't lose any war. We just left and let them have it, you know, let them have the country.
Yeah, there's a lot of misinformation, as usual.
But our Vietnam veterans are killing themselves. The ones that they're still alive still have trouble. So my mission with this book and my mission with speaking is getting out there, talking to veterans, getting on talk shows, doing whatever I can to let people know our story, that we need to have our own parade. You know, President Trump did name, what was it, March 29th, Vietnam Veterans Day. But, you know, I'm on Facebook, and nobody even said anything about it. I mean, it goes went right by, and nobody said, well, happy Vietnam Veterans Day. You know, they still don't honor us.
Yeah,
we never had our parade.
I agree, and I see that, you know, it's become like the cliche thing, you know, and I'm sitting in the airport for hours, and every time they announce to load a flight, it's, on veterans, thank you for your service. It's almost like something people say.
It's compulsory almost.
Yeah, it's almost like, hi, how are you? Thank you for your service. But what frustrates me is nobody is willing to do anything. Like, you know, Trump can name that as, you know, Vietnam Day, but then let's do something. And not just a parade, but let's help people that need help. And
well, these young kids.
Yeah, go ahead. I was
kids that come back and you know, Syria. I mean, they're scarred, and they don't have constant days in combat like we did. I think, you know, their biggest fear is being blown up with an IUD or something like that. And
yes,
they, you know, a lot of these movies are made like on based on one experience. But you take us, a Marine company. You're on operations more than 300 days out of your year over there in a jungle in an area of operation. I mean, everything happens every night. Even if you're not in contact, you're in fear of stepping on a booby trap or, you know, getting your throat slit on an ambush or something like that. It's just, it was totally, it was a constant trauma. And, you know, psychologically it plays a big game on you, but, you know, that's why, you know, when we come back, you know, they didn't really have the treatment set up for us. They didn't really understand us. They didn't really think that we went through all that stuff. Any stories that are coming out now, you know, when I wrote the book, I left out a bunch of scenes, and some of my squad said, well, you got to write the helicopter scene, you know, where we were shot down behind enemy lines over in Laos. And, you know, if you ever watched the movie Platoon, we were pursued by the NVA for several days and nights in a jungle where they were trying to kill us before we could get an extraction helicopter in to get out of there. Plus, we had dead and wounded we were carrying with us. So it was one scene that I didn't write in the original book. And some of my squad said, you got to do that, Danny. I said, well, refresh my memory. And you know, there it's in the book towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I just want to bring honor to all the veterans and help all the veterans if I can. You know, once you're in combat, I mean, there's only so many ways you can be shot at and so forth. I mean, I have two Purple Hearts. I didn't have the third one, but I could have had 100 if we got one for every wound that we got. The Purple Hearts are when you really can't function anymore, or they have to, you know, have a corpsman come up and sew you up or something. But, you know, my little squad, a lot of us got Medals of Honor, you know, the Bronze Star, Vietnam Gallantry Cross. We got several dozen Purple Hearts and so forth, just in the gun guys that we were in. And, you know, we were just kids and going through a time that and doing what we were told. And, you know, America should be proud of us. I mean, you know, all my kids are older than 19, but I couldn't imagine my kids at 19 going to war.
Yeah.
I mean, they're on their cell phone, and, you know, they like to play video games, and they don't even want to, you know, be bothered, much less, you know, being in combat and dropped in a hot LZ and, you know, go kill these people.
Yeah, the most combat they see is on Call of Duty.
Yeah.
That's true, though.
So, Danny, you've consulted with your other squad members that you were able to put back together for the writing of this book. What are their feelings, and how do they feel about the book and their input into it?
Well, they haven't seen the finished product. I mean, I've given them a sneak preview on it, but they are very excited that they'll be honored in it and named in it, and then our story and our legacy will carry on.
So, now, what is the one memory that you can share with the listeners in Vietnam that still stays with you today?
We don't have a lot of them. Would it be on a mission? Is it a question about a mission or just my overall experience?
Your overall experience.
Well, you know, I grew from a kid to a man, like, overnight. I mean, you grow up fast. And Marines teach you, no matter what, if something happens to a superior above you, you have to step up and lead. And so, you know, through that, more than a year that I was there and all those combat missions, I mean, I grew up a lot. You know, and being near death helps you open up a new spiritual side of you where you just stop worrying about death and worry about dying, but you leave it in God's hands, and then you're not afraid anymore. I mean, I was never afraid after I got to that point. Look, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. I don't have any control over it. And I was that way as a cop when I got back, too, and people didn't understand it. I just, look, after you face fear and conquer it, and you get to the other side, then you're not afraid anymore. And that was the biggest thing, I guess, is learning how to handle fear, conquer, and get onto the other side where you can actually do your job under a high-stress situation and not react. So my biggest memory is just surviving when so many others didn't. And why am I still here? And I guess that's why I'm here to write this book. You know, it's things just happen that way. It's like when I met Chuck Norris, you know, everybody said, well, you know Chuck Norris. Well, Chuck's just an average guy like we are. And he was in the Air Force and stuff. His brother sadly got killed in Vietnam, and Chuck has a really big passion about the military in Vietnam. And you know, but through a series of events, you know, we had mutual friends, and we were led together. And we've been together. I just saw him 2 weeks ago in Lexington, Kentucky. And we've been friends for 38 years, and I've known him before he was a big movie star. And, you know, people cross people's paths, just like me and a Greek in this book, for a reason, and it's a journey we take together, and you just don't fight it, you just roll with it. Like this book, I never anticipated writing it until 2 years ago. Then all of a sudden it's come pouring out of me, and here it is. It's going to become a reality on May the 1st, and people will either like it or not like it, but if you read the endorsements, it's been endorsed by high-ranking Marine Corps officers that are really complimenting me for writing the book.
So I've got to ask this, because every soldier or Marine, I'm sorry, you know, it's amazing what you can come up with to keep your morale up in the middle of the crap. So what kind of things did you guys do to keep up each other's morale?
We play tricks on people, on each other a lot, you know, I don't think you read the book and stuff, but what would we do out there? I mean, just tease each other. We'd throw bayonets at each other, you know, and see how close we come to each other's feet. And then we would, you know, just make fun of each other any way we could. And every once in a while, you know, somebody would get a package, you know, from the world, which would be, you know, have a little bit of liquor in it or some potato chips or something like that. So we would all go crazy over stuff like that. And, you know, you get out there, you get pretty much delirious. I mean, two of my squad, you know, wanted to go on R&R, and we were really battle-weary. And you'll read about it in the book. So I said, you want to go on R&R, just, you know, drop your pants off, throw a grenade out here, and, you know, you'll get a little shrapnel on your butt and go to Tokyo for a couple of weeks. So, you know, they were fighting about who was going to throw their grenade, and they were convinced about, you know, okay, we'll do that, but make sure, you know, you throw it far enough out because we don't want to get killed. And they kept arguing about who was going to throw the grenade, so I just pulled the pin, and I threw it out and said, you got 3 seconds to make a decision. So when the grenade blew up, you know, blew debris all over them, but they didn't get any shrapnel to the point that they would be medevaced, and so, you know, everybody thought we were being attacked, so they opened up, and, you know, we had to call in that, you know, everything was okay. But the next morning, I guess when I threw the grenade out, it landed behind a log, and it absorbed most of the blast. So, you know, we laughed about that, but then, you know, they didn't try it anymore after that. They thought I was crazy, but, you know, I got tired of them saying, you know, I'm sick of this stuff. I need to get out of here and stuff. And I said, well, I'll drop your pants, and I'll help you out.
I mean, as a soldier, I'm picturing it in my head. You know, you got this ring of guys with their pants down all pointing in a circle, and you're tossing a grenade in the middle.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, to the average person, that's got to sound, you know, insane, but it makes perfect sense.
No, not when you're out there not knowing if that's your last day or not. You know, we're getting hit every day, and we've been through some they actually sent us over to Laos to stop the NBA, you know, regulars coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And so we're over there, and you know, they've got 20,000 of them coming at us, and we've got 100 and some men on the mountain. you know, and they overrun us and did us a job for about 3 or 4 days and nights, you know, to the point we were almost out of ammunition. And sometimes these Marine Corps commanders that draw up these battle plans, you know, they don't have any clue how they're going to turn out. They look good on paper, you know, but they're going to execute them, but was not. So I had to question sometimes the people who drew up some of these great ideas. It sounds good. Let's go over here and drop, you know, block all these people coming down from the north. And if you ever seen any video footage, you see how they come down. And, in the trucks and under the cover of darkness. And then, you know, they come down thousands of times. I mean, we were right there in the middle of them trying to block them from coming into the south as a blocking force. And we were outgunned and outmanned and everything. And it was a suicide mission for us.
Yeah. And like you said, after a while, you just don't fear death anymore. My father was in Vietnam, 67 and 68. And during the Tet Offensive, he was actually pinned down in an old French guard shack for 3 days. And every time he'd bring his head up, you know, they would open fire on him. And finally, he just said, you know what? If it's going to happen, today's going to be the day. And he got up and walked out in the middle of rifle fire.
Yeah, that's amazing.
But now, all of these experiences, you know, from Vietnam to your police work, you know, to your martial arts, all of that has led you to a detective group, if I understand right. Do you do private investigations, or did you at some point?
Yeah, I still do. I do high-profile private investigative cases. I've done over 200 murder cases as a PI in the last 38 years.
Oh, wow.
And I've been hired as an expert in a lot of cases, and I'm actually writing some memoirs on a lot of my top cases, murder mysteries and things like that that you may be interested in down the line. But, yeah, I still do that. Like I say, I'm trying to retire, but every time I, you know, the phone rings and somebody has a nice advanced retainer, I always change my mind. And, I've trained my wife to be a PI, and she's probably better than me now, just like I taught her how to shoot, and she's a better shot than me. So she and I work together. It's kind of like heart to heart. You know, the old Robert Wagner and
the other girl. Yeah, we're dating ourselves now.
Yeah, and then, you know, we have our adventures. We do surveillance, and we have to dress up and go in each bar and search for people. Then we work murder cases. We work all kinds of, we just work a wide variety of cases. So it's pretty interesting, but, you know, I'm really ready to retire and just make some money on writing books.
Well, like you said, you know, that retainer, that money, you know, it'll change a man's mind.
Yeah, we stay busy. I mean, we develop a real estate company, and we buy and flip houses. We're, you know, we have two on the market right now, and there's always a mystery and something going on with them. And I'm thinking, well, what next? You know, my ultimate goal and her goal is to buy the beach house on the beach and walk hand in hand barefooted down the beach, you know, like everybody had that dream. So we're trying to get there in the next couple of years, but I don't know if that'll happen at all.
Now, Danny, do you travel around and lecture at veterans groups or VA hospitals?
That is my intention. As soon as the book comes out, I have a lot of people waiting to see it, so that will be my goal, is to get scheduled to do those. I've sent out a lot of articles, and I've written about a 10-page memo called The Reality of Combat, and it talks about the psychological conditioning of a combatant, what you have to go through in order to be able to react and survive in a situation, and also what you have to do to survive after it. So it's pretty heavy and intense. It's been endorsed by the Marine Corps. It's been taught and used as a guide to help these veterans overcome things. I'd be glad to send that to you. But mainly, I still do a lot of martial arts seminars. I'll be in Seattle the second weekend of September doing a 3-day clinic there in Shoreline. And we have an affiliate there, USA Karate and Shoreline. I'll be there training people for 2 days. I teach personal protection and things of that sort. But that'll be my goal, is to get out to more veterans groups and anybody that would listen. But also, you know, we do motivational talk where you actually, it's basically based on overcoming atrocities and achieving, you know, greatness through overcoming obstacles and atrocities. So you can go through these things, overcome them, and then you can actually put that into a business plan and say, you know, and my wife always has this saying, you know, anytime I get frustrated or have anxiety and get irritated about something, she said, well, it's not as bad as Vietnam, is it? I started laughing about it. So I know nothing was as bad as Vietnam. She said, well, you got to put it in the right context, you know. You know, nothing would be that bad again. So, you know, it's not all that bad to start with. So we have, she has fun with that. When I get this anxiety over somebody and or something that's going on, that nothing's that bad, I don't guess.
Well, you know, because it'd be nice to see you. Actually, I'd like to see you in September up in Seattle. But it'd be great to see you move around and speak to also police groups, because I think that this wisdom, you know, goes beyond military. Like you said, a lot of us veterans go into some type of police work, and I think it's subconsciously because we want to feel that sense of being alive again, for lack of better terms.
Yeah, I miss being in law enforcement very much. I left under duress. I worked a high-profile murder case as a detective, and it involved some corrupt cops inside my own department, which I tried to get indicted, but, you know, I went to trial three times over a period of 6.5 years, and because of who I tried to take down inside our department, it destroyed my career, and I had to walk away to keep from actually killing some of my own people, because, I mean, in some agencies, you got people that are bad people that either are involved in drug trafficking or murder in this case, you know, stopping witnesses from testifying. And this case I'm talking about actually had the organized crime involved in it with drug running in from Colombia, South America. So I walked away to keep from killing somebody and going to prison for the rest of my life. I ended up walking away, turning the badge, and, you know, I was with Chuck Norris at that time, and, you know, doing some movies with Chuck. I did Code of Silence in 85 in Chicago as a stuntman, and he was getting me more involved. So I had, you know, I had something to go to. I had the schools, I had some Chuck Norris schools. They were doing well. And I said, you know, why go to prison for killing this piece of crap when I can just go ahead and walk away and, you know, somebody else will kill him for us on down the line, or he'll die a miserable death. And
true.
So I did that. You know, instead of waiting for 20 years to retire, I left at 15 years to keep from doing something stupid. Actually, it's one of the cases I'm writing now, one of the books I'm writing now, is called 1523 Charleston. That's where this murder happened, where I walked in as a homicide detective and found this girl still breathing but had been shot in the head to make it look like a suicide. So this whole case involves me figuring out how she got there, who killed her, or did she shoot herself, and who was responsible for it. So the whole book unraveled this whole murder conspiracy involving organized crime and also dirty cops.
Well, that sounds like a whole other show we'll have to have you on for.
Well, unfortunately, it has to be a fiction type of novel, because some of the people still are alive and still could be indicted for it, even though they probably won't. But, you know, I had to change the names to not, you know, for litigation purposes.
Right. Well, you know, like they used to open with Dragnet, you know, names have been changed to protect the innocent or not so innocent. You know how we get away with that, Danny, is we call it historical fiction.
Well, it's about that. I'm about, you know, I'm going to make it more of a short story and not make it a 240-page novel, but it'll probably be done in 2 or 3 months if I get back to writing on it. Went along this book and go on a book signing tour a little bit with Barnes & Noble's already ordered 350 copies for the book for their stores. And, of course, it'll be an audio version, Kindle, and online on Amazon, Books A Million, Barnes & Noble. Plus, if they go to somegaveitall.com, there's a lot of information on there about the book and other Marine and missions that's on there, acts of valor, these other Marine missions and people that have shared their stories with me. We're hoping to make that a blog for people to be able to post their stories of valor that they did and tell the world, you know, their story. Everybody has a story and everybody needs to know it.
Right. Now, you also have another website, DannyLane.com.
Yeah, that's my multi-purpose website, because I have my martial arts studios on there. I have my private investigative firm on there. I have the new video series I just did with a CI agent, Jason Hansen, called Spy Combat. It is on there. So you can just click on a banner and it takes you to different business opportunities or services that I do and have. And Jason and I had developed a new program. It's really for the general public, you know, where we teach, active shooter stuff. We teach how to survive in any situation, being kidnapped, duct taped, or tied up, handcuffed, stuck in trunks of cars, and, you know, along with the basic self-defense. So the Spy Combat is he's been on Shark Tank. He's been on NBC News with Lester Holt. He's been on Dateline. He's been on, we had our own show over on the Strip in Las Vegas at the Stratosphere for a while, where people would come up out of the audience and he'd show people how to survive, you know, these different types of attacks. So it's an up-and-coming way of self-defense for the general public. You don't have to be in great shape. You don't have to go to school. You can watch the videos or attend one of our seminars or something like that and learn all these secrets that, you know, that we teach.
Well, what if I like the handcuffs, Danny?
Well, then we'll just double lock them and throw away the key.
So, Danny, how can people, and I'm especially talking, you know, to veterans out there, how can people get in touch with you personally and take advantage of your military experience and how you've overcome a lot of the things that have happened to you?
Well, through both of my websites, DannyLane.com and also FunGaveItAll.com, there are online forms where they can fill out and put their personal information. I get right back to them. Plus my phone numbers on my Facebook page. I mean, it's very easy to get a hold of. I mean, there's the only other pop, if you Google me, it pulls up, you know, like thousands of different pages of data that people can get in touch with me very easily. And I have veterans that get a hold of me already and tell me their stories and tell me about their dreams and their nightmares. And, you know, I'm already, you know, talking to these people, and it's very gratifying that I can help them, and I'm trying to help them through some of their hard times, because, you know, people that are even in their later years, they're not really that healthy and so forth, and they're still suffering. You know, I've been back 50 years this year. And I'm still suffering. I mean, I still have sleepless nights. I still have anxiety. I still have all these things. But the only way I can get over it, I go to the gym and hit the weights. I go upstairs, and we have a home gym, and hit the heavy bag and kick a few times. And, you know, I do things that just distracts my mind from going back into that deep black hole that I've been in for all these years. I mean, you know, the post-traumatic stress, I mean, it affects who you are. It really robs you of your happiness, of your love, your ability to love, and robs you of just being a normal person. And veterans, you know, they just don't understand where we're coming from. They have all these treatments, and they put you on all this medicine. I could give you a picture of all the medicine these people have given me, and you'd think that I was a drug addict. And, you know, you go in there, and they want to put you on a prescription. Well, we'll see you in 3 months or 6 months. I mean, and it's a joke. It doesn't work.
It doesn't stop the dreams or the survivor's guilt. You know, if I can just throw that in.
Well, it's like I ended up on the back of the book. You'll see something. It says, you know, at the very last sentence, it says, war is hell, but for some, surviving is worse. And that's why so many people kill themselves, because they can't stop the pain. They would have rather died over there than come home and face what they have faced for 50 years. A lot of them. And I've almost been there. So many, many times that I'd rather die than go through another day and take another breath. And, you know, through the love of my wife and understanding with her, and, you know, she's seen me do it and threatened to do it. And she said, you know, you gotta get some other help. You gotta write this out. You gotta get through this somehow. You can't get through it until you ask forgiveness. You gotta let this thing go before it destroys you. And that's the message of it. If you don't let it go, it will destroy you and it will kill you. That's why we call it the silent killer.
Yes, sir. Well, before we run out of any more time, Danny, one veteran to another, I want to give you a heartfelt thank you. You know, thank you for speaking out. Thank you for writing this book, and thank you for being with us today and sharing your experiences.
Well, I had been unspoken for almost 50 years before I started writing the book, so but I've got a lot to say now, as you can tell. And I'm going to be in Seattle the second week of September, and both of you guys have an invitation not to come and meet for a talk, but to work out with me. And I pattern my seminars for the general public as well. And so, you know, I'm challenging you guys to come up in to Shoreline. I'll send you the address and work out with me either Friday or Saturday or both days and learn something and you know, share some time together and get to know each other.
Yeah.
Well, it's a good thing you're telling us in April. I got training to do then. I gotta get in shape for this. I haven't had a ring fight since '96.
Well, we're not going to put on the gloves and fight, but it'll be, you know, it'll be realistic self-defense, and you know, maybe I can duct tape you up and see if you can get out of it.
Oh, now that I'd pay for.
Wow. Well, Danny,
well,
thank you.
It's a date, you know. I'm already booked to go out there, and then you know, I'll send you the address and so forth. So, I'd like for you to come, and if you want me to be back on the show or out there, let me know so I can stay out an extra day or two and put that on my schedule.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Welcome to Stephen's True Crime Commentary. Discussions of forensics, how it's done, and true crime interest.
Welcome back to Stephen's True Crime Commentary, and as usual, I am Stephen David Lampley. All right, what I have for you today is pretty interesting, at least I think so, and most others do. We're going to talk about glitter and pollen as evidence. Now, this is a lot more involved than you may possibly realize, so let's get started with this. Now, before we actually get into the glitter and pollen, let me go over with you a forensic principle called Lockhart's principle. Lockhart's principle basically states that a criminal will bring something to the crime scene and will take something away from the crime scene. For instance, a criminal may come to the crime scene, leave a thumbprint, hair, or something on the scene, and the criminal may leave the crime scene and leave with fiber on their body. So they're going to bring something to the crime scene. They will leave with something from the crime scene. Now, let's talk about glitter first. Glitter is entirely man-made from plastic or foil, and it can be multi-layered. Glitter is usually cut into very tiny pieces, usually cut into hexagons, squares, or rectangles. And the reason for that is that those shapes will allow the glitter manufacturer to use all of the glitter sheet to manufacture glitter. In other words, there's no waste. Everything goes to manufacture glitter. Now, the hexagon cuts are the most common cuts, followed by square. Usually, if you're looking at glitter on your finger or on a table or something, usually the glitter is tiny enough that without some visual aid, a microscope or something, you typically can't tell the shape of it by looking at it. You just tell that it glistens. All right, now glitter begins as mica, and then color and sparkle are added with titanium dioxide. There may also be bismuth oxychloride or iron oxide coatings, which may also be applied. All right, glitter is found in almost all cosmetics. Now, there's very few glitter manufacturers across the world, and they exist in, let's see here, China, Korea, Taiwan, there's Pakistan, Germany, India, and of course the United States. Now, glitter can come in over 40 colors. 44, I think, is the most colors that one manufacturer makes. And the sizes range from about 50 microns to 1/4 inch in size. Glitter is extremely traceable. Even the cuts that are made on the glitter can vary from manufacturer to manufacturer. In other words, there have been cases where the glitter was manufactured, it was cut, even the smallest of pieces, and because the glitter cutting is so different from manufacturer to manufacturer, they can tell which manufacturer made that glitter particle simply by the cut that's on it. Now, Glitter is searchable in a database that's available to detectives where they can, when they come up with the evidence and they have the colors and the makeup of the glitter, they can search and see who actually manufactured that glitter, and it will pop up and tell them. Glitter is environmentally durable, and for instance, it has been found in a vehicle's carpet years after the case, and it was still traceable. Glitter is an excellent trace evidence substance. It sticks and it does not come off easily. All right, let's talk about pollen for a moment. Pollen is not limited to flowers. Seems like a lot of people think, oh, pollen comes from flowers. Pollen comes from more than flowers, trees, bushes, shrubs, grass. So it's not limited to flowers. Pollen can measure 20 micrometers or 1/50th of a millimeter. It's very, very small. Pollen is also very diverse, and it comes in different shapes, it comes in different sizes, and it comes in different colors. It is possible to look at a pollen particle and tell the species of plant that it came from. There are so many different varieties, it's easy to pick the plant, the species that it came from. Now this is going to be interesting, each environmental habitat has different plants and a different pollen signature. Now follow me closely here. By the proportions or the pollen combinations, in other words, by the pollen amount produced or the pollen combinations from the different plants in that area, one can tell exactly where that pollen particle came from, what area. This is what you call pollen forensics. Now, one thing about pollen is that it can remain on clothing even after it has been washed. Pollen found in a murder suspect's clothing can be used to identify the area it came from, and then in an area small enough that a cadaver dog can be brought into and locate the victim. Glitter and pollen are tremendous, tremendous trace evidence substances. All right, our time's up. I do hope that you were able to take something away from this commentary. I want to thank you for joining me, and I'll see you next time.
Thank you for tuning into Stephen's True Crime Commentary, heard across America. You are invited to visit Stephen's website for information on his books, speaking dates, and speaking programs like How to Catch a Liar. In this seminar, Stephen explains some of the very same techniques police detectives use to help them determine if someone is lying. You will learn such things as global versus individual indicators, use of contractions, voice tone, eye shift, evasion, allusion, pronoun usage, question pause, base shift, and much more. Go to StephenDavidLampley.com for information on this seminar and much more.
Crime Commentary is a production of Something Weird Media and West 53rd Productions, with music by JasonLampley.com.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.